Listen, we understand the emotions of fans, but a section of them went overboard and damaging their own stadium, breaching their own stadium, throwing missiles at the police. I think it's pretty clear that's too far in terms of protest.
What's too far in European soccer these days is in the eye of the beholder. Because to many of those protesters at Old Trafford Stadium, the hallowed home of Manchester United, so much of Sunday's chaos felt deserved, even overdue, as the smoke billowed and the scheduled match between Liverpool and Man United got postponed. So today, Sam Borden surveys this populist revolution, ignited by the failed European Super League, which, even in death, continues to push English soccer to the brink. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, May 4th. This is ESPN Daily.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Sam Borden, thank you for joining me, man.
Absolutely, Pablo. Great to be with you.
Sam Borden is a global sports correspondent for ESPN. I've been looking forward to talking to you for 2 weeks exactly now. That's how long it's been since we talked about the Super League, and we'll get into the postmortem on the Super League. We'll get into the Champions League semifinal games that are being held today. But first of all, what happened over the weekend, Sam, has taken precedence, overshadowing all of that and connecting directly to all of that. So how would you describe what we saw happen on Sunday?
Well, Pablo, I think the best way to describe it is chaos. There was a game in the Premier League between Liverpool and Manchester United at Old Trafford, which is one of the historic soccer stadiums in the entire world. And the game was postponed, not because of rain or some kind of, you know, natural disaster, but because fans protesting against the Super League's existence broke into Old Trafford, broke into the stadium, onto the field, and protested against what their own team's owners were doing to the club.
Remarkable scenes here, Rebecca. Lee Dixon and myself got here to the gantry at Old Trafford a little early so that we could avoid the protests outside. Well, the noise outside was clearly audible from inside the stadium. We heard a couple of loud bangs as well as fireworks went off. Then all of a sudden there was a loud rattling sound, and then the sound of voices getting closer and closer. And lo and behold, away to our right hand side, the fans started pouring down the steps here in the Sir Bobby Charlton stand and onto the pitch. And you can see now
there was violence. There were police officers who were hurt. There were flares set off. Pablo, I don't know the best way to describe this for like an American audience other than to say, imagine if the Yankees and the Red Sox were supposed to play a game and a bunch of fans broke into Fenway Park and essentially made it impossible for the players to get on the field.
Yeah, it is something that I cannot recall happening in the United States. I cannot recall a good analog for what we saw, Sam. And to be clear here, there was like this legal, planned, allowed protest at the hotel. That's where it all started. It was supposed to be something that was contained. But then when it gets to the actual field, when they get inside, Sam, like to just continue that Yankees Red Sox analogy, I can't imagine baseball fans being able to just enter the property of Yankee Stadium without like some amount of real resistance. It just seems unfathomable to me. How did they actually just break into this building.
Yeah, Pablo, it is pretty crazy. I mean, I think it's important to realize, right, like there was supposed to be a game there. So it wasn't like, you know, the padlocks were on the gates, but we've seen reports of barriers being broken down. I saw pictures of fans literally holding like those metal barriers that keep fans back before they're allowed to. And obviously they had numbers. And so I think when you're talking about, you know, an hour and a half, two hours before the game, you have numbers and you have people that have the will to force their way in, you're going to see ugly scenes like we saw on Sunday.
So we've seen supporters of Arsenal, of Liverpool, of Leeds United, Man City, Chelsea. We've seen supporters protesting outside of their stadiums over the past couple of weeks. So just to make clear here, what are the fans who are doing this? What do they want?
Change. When it comes to Manchester United, they want the Glazers to sell the team.
The Glazers being the billionaire American family that owns Man United and the NFL's Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
This has been an ongoing issue for over a decade. Literally 10 years ago, there was a plan in place where unhappy Manchester United fans had sort of banded together and recruited rich, deep-pocketed locals to try to force a takeover of Manchester United. And that fell through. And I think the fans look at the Glazers and say, we want our old club back. We want to feel proud of what our club means and what it represents.
And so I want to relate all of this back to what we talked about a fortnight ago, Sam. And I will say that because it all sounds very European now.
Very, very nice, Pablo. Great use of the terminology. Love it.
A fortnight ago, we were talking to you about what these owners, the Glazer family and others, the owners of a dozen or so of the biggest high-profile franchises in world football, they wanted to come together and create this Super League. It triggered, as we can see now, the smoking embers of a populist uprising. Maybe the biggest one in Europe since the French Revolution. Don't fact-check me on that. But that's what it feels like to me, Sam. So what happened, in short, to the Super League?
Yeah, Pablo, I mean, there are some bad jokes to be made about Marie Antoinette and this league being deader than she is, or or Napoleon at Waterloo and it going about as well as that went for him. But I think The bottom line is that it's dead for the moment. And the reason that it died is twofold. One, the fans, no doubt about it. The pushback on this thing was massive. For all of the PR people that these big-time owners and teams presumably have on their payroll, the rollout of this plan was horrendous. There was no dialogue at all with the fans. There was no dialogue with the players. There was no dialogue with really anybody other than this small coterie of rich owners who had found a way to enrich themselves even more. And so the backlash, as we just talked about before, from everybody else essentially, was strong and swift, and it made a difference. But I think also it's important to say too that the reason why it died ultimately was because UEFA, the European governing body that sort of runs European soccer, they made it clear that there were going to be real ramifications for these teams if they left. The president of UEFA, Alexander Seferin, he was very strategic. And at first he sort of, you know, brought the stick. He said, look, if you guys leave, you're essentially going to be traitorous. You're going to ruin everything else in European football. You're going to decrease the value of these domestic leagues that you say are important. You're going to put your own players in jeopardy in terms of being able to play in big competitions like the Euros or the World Cup, because you'll be playing in an unsanctioned league, and that's against our bylaws. So Seferin very specifically targeted these teams and said, here are the ramifications, here are the consequences. And then once he saw the backlash from the fans, he opened the door strategically and said, look, you guys know that you're making a mistake. And if you want to admit that you're making a mistake, we'll welcome you back. And ultimately, within a day, the English teams all got in line and said, okay, we see this backlash. We see all this negativity. We see how there's no way this can go forward. We're out. At that point, the Super League was dead. And it was as though it had never existed until these protests, which now have all of a sudden brought the issue back front and center.
Did they really not anticipate that any of this would happen? Because it is one thing to be surprised by how unpopular it is. It is another thing to not realize that it is so unpopular that it's going to be dead within 48 hours. And also, people are going to be breaking into the stadiums of these teams as a matter of formal revolt.
No, I completely agree, Pablo. I mean, I'm not a PR executive, obviously, but it seems fairly stunning that that wasn't something that was, you know, given some significant thought. But I think it's also important to understand, particularly in England, that this is sort of one piece of a much, much, much larger issue, and that's foreign ownership, right? I mean, these clubs historically were community clubs. Even big clubs like Manchester United, which is one of the biggest sports teams in the world, initially it was a bunch of railway workers. Even now, the fans still look at those clubs, even worth billions and billions of dollars, as community assets, as the focus of these people who are from this place. The majority of clubs in English football, the top levels of English football, are owned by non-British owners. And so you have Man City, owned essentially by the royal family in Abu Dhabi. You have a bunch of American...
Wait, Sam, we got to stop for a second here. For those who are not familiar with the dynamic of Manchester City being owned basically by a nation state, that feels like a turning point in sports history, maybe.
It's 100% right. I mean, literally, it's Sheikh Mansour and his family, and they financed Man City. I mean, they turned Manchester City from a club that was sort of an also-ran, the Mets of Manchester, to the Yankees, Manchester United, into level playing field. In fact, you would even say probably Man City is on their way to winning the Premier League this year. I mean, they've surpassed Man United in terms of success. So you have a royal family, like you said, a nation state with Man City. You have a Russian oligarch owns Chelsea, Chinese owners, Malaysian owners, American owners, John Henry and the Fenway Group own Liverpool. So you have essentially this massive disconnect where these owners are looking at these clubs as purely financial assets, and you have these fans who look at them as community institutions.
Does it feel like these protests can actually push those owners out?
I mean, the bottom line is that this is professional sports. You know, it is entertainment. It is big business. And so while I appreciate and admire and respect tremendously the connection that a lot of these fans and these fan groups have to these clubs, I also think that we have to be realistic. These fans love everything about the big money owners when it comes to signing the best players, for example.
Paying these enormous transfer fees.
Exactly. But, you know, the truth is that, like, playing in the FA Cup isn't bringing in the billions of dollars that playing in the Champions League or the Super League would bring into the pockets of the club that they love so much and would ultimately lead to them being able to sign more expensive players. So while I think that, you know, the sentiment behind the protests is fair enough, ultimately, deep-pocketed foreign owners are going to buy big-name clubs in international football. That's not going to change. And I think, Pablo, we can talk about this a little more as we go, but the premise of the Super League is not so ridiculous at all. I think what we've seen from these protests and what we're seeing in the backlash is largely based on the way that it was gone about. You know, Alexander Seferin, the head of UEFA, gave a quote to the New York Times in which he said, even mafia organizations have some kind of a code. I think that that sentiment is probably fairly representative of what was driving the emotion here. But I think ultimately the rollout, the idea that there was no consultation, that it was simply let's make the rich get richer without any thought for anybody else, I think that is what ultimately is the match and, you know, the gasoline for this raging fire.
So one proposal that the protesters seem to be behind, Sam, in some number at least, is the German model. And when we talked last time on the pod, you had mentioned that there were no German teams in the Super League. They were not among that dozen, even though they're among the top clubs in the world, because German teams are required to have a 51% fan ownership model. Is that model, is that sort of hybrid, is that something you see the English Premier League adopting?
It's difficult for me to imagine, Pablo. I mean, I love it. I think it's a tremendous idea. And I think that it allows the German league to look at these issues in a very different way. Bayern Munich would feel like a perfect team to have joined the Super League, but they were never significantly in the mix because of this situation, because they knew that without consultation with their fans, something like this wouldn't be possible in the way that it was for clubs like Liverpool or Man United or Barcelona. Ultimately, I think it would take a big sea change in the way that English football is run. There are also plenty of teams in English football that are struggling to stay afloat because the cost of running a team in this day and age is a lot higher than it was 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so I think, yes, would it be ideal if fans had a more formalized say in English football? Sure, absolutely. But I think when you get right down to the dollars and the cents or the pounds and the pence, it's a lot harder to pull off than it might seem.
All right, Sam, on that rhyming note, I want to talk about the gasoline and potentially the fire that is now about to leak into the Champions League semifinals that start today.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Sam, as we track what is unfolding across world football right now, the UEFA Champions League, the semifinals, the biggest, most massively popular soccer tournament for all of Europe is underway today. And so it is awkward because they're playing under the specter of these protests in England and also just under the specter of the fact that a bunch of its teams that are involved in this just tried to leave. What does this all mean, Sam, for the games themselves?
Well, I'll tell you what, Pablo. I think the people that are most disappointed is probably Paris Saint-Germain and their fans, because as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, there was a moment when the Super League was being discussed, when it seemed possible that one of the ramifications for the teams that were going to be part of the Super League was that they would be kicked out of UEFA competitions. Mm. And so Paris Saint-Germain was the only team of the four in the semifinals that wasn't supposed to go to the Super League.
Right.
So there was this thought, well, okay, does that mean that they're the Champions League winners for this year? If Man City and Chelsea and Real Madrid are kicked out, celebrate Paris. As it turns out, like you said, Pablo, they actually are going to have to play the semifinal and try to win it on their own. But I think that we're going to see some more protests for sure. Man City fans feel like UEFA has had it out for them for a while. So it's a little bit of a weird situation that they're now pushing to be a part of this Champions League thing as opposed to the Super League thing. But Chelsea fans showed their colors. They blocked the team buses before a game a couple of weeks ago, right after the Super League stuff came out. So I don't know that we're going to see violence like we saw on Sunday. I certainly hope that we don't, but I think we'll definitely see the vestiges of the fan uprising from the Super League as the Champions League continues.
And all of this, Sam, it's important to note, is unfolding in England. So today, Manchester City is hosting Paris Saint-Germain, as you referenced. Tomorrow, Chelsea is hosting Real Madrid at Stamford Bridge right in London. And now, since the criticism, Sam, has been sort of like levied against those teams that tried to break away from the Champions League, and because UEFA has been dealing with those top teams wanting a bigger slice of the financial pie for years now, I'm just curious what the impact is going to be on all of these negotiations that are about to play out in the coming years.
Well, that's the thing, Pablo. It's crazy because while this was going on with the Super League, UEFA and the clubs were finalizing a new deal for the Champions League. I mean, that was one of the things that Alexander Seferin, the president of UEFA, was most bothered by, was that he felt as though many of the leaders at the Super League clubs were essentially being double agents. They were talking to him and other clubs about, okay, we're going to revamp the Champions League. Here's what we're going to do, while also kind of behind everybody's back, putting together this breakaway Super League. So as you said, there are changes coming. There were changes in the works anyway to the Champions League. And I think that they are designed to try to expand the pie, make it bigger, and also give a larger piece to the biggest clubs.
So what is UEFA doing here, Sam, in terms of acknowledging that the world they inhabit is one that has now been changed by this Super League proposal?
What's going to happen in the future, starting in 2024, is that the Champions League is expanding from 32 to 36 teams. So bringing in more clubs, more opportunities for teams to be a part of this, expanding the pie. But instead of having this group stage format, they're going to play a single table. Each team will play 10 games. So for the people that have been following the Super League, that might sound kind of similar. The difference is that unlike in the Super League, where the vast majority of the teams were guaranteed to remain in the Super League, whether they were good or bad, whether they had a tremendous year or the worst year ever, in the new Champions League, the meritocracy component will remain. You are going to have to earn your way in year after year. And that was the issue, Pablo. The idea that these big-time clubs were getting together and forming this small group, this closed shop, where the only way to get in was to have enough money as opposed to enough goals.
Yeah, that seems to be, Sam, like the kind of philosophical undercurrent to all of this. It felt insulting almost on a real, almost cellular level to European football fans who were like, look, something you don't get about us is that the way we do sports, there is a real reckoning for those who finish at the very bottom of the standings. It feels like once you realize how Europe does it, you realize that we're playing sports with this almost like child safety net underneath, where worst case scenario, you'll get right back in there and do it again. But relegation as a concept is explicitly, you will not be back here to do this again next year.
Exactly right. When you see a club like Leicester City, who won the Premier League from out of nowhere several years ago and had literally not even been in the Premier League for years before that, that's the kind of thing that, like, it just doesn't happen in America, right? There's no way that, you know, the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Yankees are going to work their way up into the majors and take on the real Yankees, right? It doesn't happen.
It's so fundamental, Sam, to the very premise of sports, to the very premise of soccer in Europe, that in England, we saw the royal family, we saw the prime minister get involved in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, Pablo, I'm certainly not an expert on the laws and the, you know, the way that the government operates in England. But I think ultimately it seems to me like it would be unlikely that there would be actual legislation that would be binding. But I think that it shows you the degree to which this is an issue of importance. When you look at the fallout from the Super League, it was very clear that all of the other clubs that were going to be left behind realized very quickly that, okay, yes, obviously we're upset, but the Premier League can't exist without Man United, Man City, Liverpool. We need these clubs.
Right.
And so we need to work with them to keep them here, but also put protections in place that will safeguard the sort of identity of this league that we're a part of.
It does feel, Sam, like all of this chaos, the revolution we've seen spread across Europe, it seems like it's circling in bright yellow highlighter a larger, almost existential question of who does sport belong to?
You know, Pablo, I would like to sit here and say to you that sport belongs to the fans. I think you and I both know that that isn't the case. Saturday 3 p.m. kickoff in European football used to be a sacred thing, and now you have games that are being played at all hours so that it can maximize the TV window. Ultimately, this is business. This is entertainment. I think what this episode has taught us is that there has to be some kind of a balance between those two. You cannot tip the seesaw all the way one way. And that was what the Super League was. It was essentially an idea that would have tipped that balance way too far to one side.
Sam, at the beginning of this conversation, I mentioned to you how unreal it was to see those scenes from Old Trafford, from Manchester United's supporter base. And I just wonder, If you're an American owner right now in American sports, and you're watching what these fans are doing in England over their favorite game, what is running through your mind? How do you feel?
I'll tell you what, Pablo. Honestly, I think the people that were probably watching it the most closely are not owners of professional teams, but presidents of universities and athletic directors at big-time college football or college basketball schools.
Mm.
And I think, in fact, when you and I are talking and you're, you know, into your 27th year hosting ESPN Daily and I'm back on the show, we're going to be talking about Super Leagues or something pretty close to it in European soccer. And I wouldn't be stunned if we're also talking about it with college football or college basketball. I think that that is the future for sports. I think we all love to talk about these old rivalries and, you know, historic traditional matchups. And I think that ultimately, teams, universities, athletic associations, conferences, whatever the bodies will be, they will find a way to protect, you know, Florida, Georgia, or whatever you want to say is Harvard, Yale, whatever the example will be. But they will also find a way to maximize revenue. And the truth is that revenue going forward is probably going to be found most in these kinds of Super League arrangements.
Sam Borden, thank you as always for making sense of the dollars and pence.
Nice job, Pablo. I love it.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.